John 13, this afternoon, from verse 1 through to 7. This afternoon, we're going to talk about surrendering to service. We've looked at what it means to surrender to silence, that we might spend time alone on a regular basis, that we need to surrender to the epic story that God is working in our lives. And this afternoon, we'll look at what it means to understand service in our lives as something that we do, in fact, need to surrender ourselves to. I believe that the church in the 21st century, perhaps the church in other centuries, but certainly today, is overlooking our need to do justice and is misunderstanding what it means to do justice. And in fact, when you think of the word justice, you might not even think it of as something that you are to do so much as it is a concept and something that we apply to civilization. We have been influenced by the Platonic notion of what justice is and how it functions more than the Hebraic notion of what justice is and how it is to function in our world and in our lives. I imagine that when I use the word justice, some of you are thinking immediately about police officers doing their job, about prisons being full, about courts and courthouses and justices, supreme justices, that is to say, doing what is right and what is fair. And these ideas of justice are foreign to the Hebrew notion of what it means to do justice in this world. We know the text in Hosea, what God requires of us to walk humbly and to serve and to do justice. In Joel chapter 2, God, speaking through the prophet Joel, is addressing the church, and he is saying, I hear your songs, I hear the harps, I hear the noise of the cymbals. Apply it to the 21st century. I hear the guitars, I hear the drums, I hear the singing, and if you're not doing justice, it's noise in my ears. What does it mean, therefore, to do justice? Doing justice in the Old Testament has to do with applying fairness into situations where there's been unfairness. It has to do with taking something that's been broken and making it straight. It's taking something that has been emptied and filling it. When the Old Testament is talking about justice, it's talking about widows, the poor, the hungry, orphans, and the fatherless. And we understand when we look at these categories is that we're looking at people who have experienced crisis in their life through no fault of their own. And we look at those situations and we say, okay, we're going to come into that situation and we're going to do justice. Therefore, we need to understand justice as distinct from doing charity. And we like to talk about loving the poor and loving the orphan and loving the widow and loving the fatherless as acts of charity. And it makes us feel good. But in the Bible, they are acts of justice. Let me put it this way to make it very plain to you. If you're walking in downtown Edmonton, right, downtown Vancouver, and you hear, and this happens, you hear a baby crying in a dumpster. There's a pregnant mother, didn't know what to do, she never really showed, no one really knew, she gave birth to a child, she put it in the dumpster, and she took off. No one's going to ever know that it was her. And you hear that baby crying. Are you thinking to yourself in that moment, well, really, do I feel like volunteering?
Do I feel like doing an act of charity or goodwill? No, in that moment, you need to do an act of justice. And when we think of it in terms of justice, we immediately understand that we're not talking about behavior. That is sort of something that's simply voluntary. I work for the Salvation Army. I'm the program manager. I have 25 staff. I oversee 5 programs. I oversee our case planning, working with marginalized community, homeless people, people who are caught in the cycle of addiction, and we're trying to work with them in order to get them out of the cycle of addiction and ultimately into homes. I work with our I oversee our shelter. I oversee our outreach program. I oversee our nursing program. We're involved in giving naloxone to people who are overdosing with fentanyl and so forth, and all of the overdoses, which is such a crisis in Vancouver right now. And so we're right in the middle of all of that. And we need to understand, and as I train my staff, we're not doing charity work. We're doing justice work. And why do I consider it justice work? Here's why. Invariably, and it's interesting, the Bible tells us to love the fatherless. Now, there's a lot of reasons why different people are fatherless or can be fatherless. And there's a lot of people who are fatherless who work through all of that, through various situations, come and live a wonderful life. However, I will say this, 99.99999% of the clientele that we work with are fatherless, and there is this nastiness to them because they're fatherless. There's nothing sexy, as it were, about working with fatherless homeless people. We need to bring justice. Here's why. These are real people, as I am giving some examples, but an 11-year-old girl abandoned by her parents because they were heroin junkies, probably never knew her dad, mom couldn't raise her, went into foster care, she was not treated properly or taken care of or loved in any way. In that context, the uncle of the foster care providers, when she was 11 years old, began to take notice of her and was attracted to her. She was raped from the time she was 11 years old through to the time that she was 16 years old. At 16 years old, she begins to use opiates, perhaps beginning with smoking pot, but then she begins to use opiates, and it's not uncommon for opiate users, such as heroin users, to say, particularly the girls, will say, the first time I shoved the needle in my arm, it felt like my mother was hugging me for the very first time. And so now this girl is 21, 22 years old, and we are working with this kind of clientele, and we're trying to help them break the cycle of addiction. Another situation where there was a young man who didn't know his mother, was raised by his father, who was in the Hell's Angels. And I'll just wait for a moment. Good idea, parents. This will be uncut. And his Hell's Angels father had him cutting lines of cocaine for his friends when he was 9 years old, 10 years. That was his job. He was the guy who cut lines so that the Hell's Angels dudes could come over and just kind of snort through the party and so forth. He was 12 years old. His dad was buying him getting prostitutes for him. And now we're working with this particular man who is drinking in order to hide his pain. We need to understand that an addict uses heroin, crystal meth, or alcohol, or whatever it might be, for the exact same reason that you take Advil when you have a headache. It is pain relief, and we are never going to understand the cycle of addiction until we understand that the addict is engaging in pain relief. There is an ache in the soul from the pain that they've experienced through no fault of their own, incidentally. It is only by God's grace that you were not born to a heroin junkie. And unless you come to terms with the reality of the fact that you can say, by the grace of God, I am what I am, you will never be involved in doing justice in the world. Why do we call it justice? Because that's injustice. And when we see injustice, we need to come into the situation and not simply provide sort of this volunteer charity on Sunday afternoons, but we do justice in people's lives. And I like to speak of it in those terms because at Christmas time, I get inundated with volunteers, people calling at Christmas time, right? They start calling in the beginning of December. How can we help? How can we serve? And I'll tell you, I got so angry at one point in one phone call. I said, and I probably shouldn't have, but you know, as you've already experienced, I do say things that sometimes I shouldn't. And I was on the phone and I said, you know what? We need you in July. Don't come and serve in order to make you feel better about yourself at Christmas time because John Lennon is crooning on the radio, "So This Is Christmas, and What Have You Done?" And now we feel all bad about our lives, and so we call the Salvation Army in order to make ourselves feel good about our lives and do a little bit of volunteer charity. We don't need more volunteer charity. We need Christians who are committed to this Hebraic notion of bringing justice in this world. Three causes of homelessness. First of all, childhood trauma. Invariably and in every situation, the person who is homeless has some degree of childhood trauma. They weren't raised in a nuclear family. I mean, that can happen, but it's very rare. They were raised in a situation where they were abandoned and rejected by their parents. Raised in foster homes or whatever the situation might be. I know somebody who was on the street when they were 11 years old and they were better off on the street as an 11-year-old than they were in any other situation that they could possibly find. Childhood trauma, addiction, and mental illness. That's why people are homeless. There are other reasons. I mean, we need more housing and so forth. But those are the issues of homelessness that we need to address and that we need to wrestle with. And that we need to engage, and this is what it means to do justice. This is what Hosea meant, loving the widow, the orphan, the fatherless. Joel says, therefore, I hear all the singing, and it's noise in my ears. Away with the songs of your voices, but let justice roll down like a river. He wants our justice. May I say more than he wants the worship of our voice? There's a lot of ways to worship God, and justice is not the least of them, that's for certain. So, I'm working at the program manager. I have about 25 staff. I oversee these various programs. And within the first 6 months of me working there, you gotta understand, I mean, I'm a pastor, and it's not that I haven't worked with homeless people, and when I was a new Christian, I was kind of this long-haired dude who wanted to be a rock star but became a Christian, and I was not averse to, you know, dabbling in drugs before I was a Christian, let's just say. And so I'm not unaware of sort of the lifestyle, but to be inundated in such a lifestyle constantly was quite overwhelming, and on one occasion, there was one homeless man. He's a wonderful man. And incidentally, here's a guy. He's homeless, some mental illness, some issues with his, obviously with his childhood and so forth. And he actually also was in an accident, and that affected his cognitive abilities. And so he was living on the street and wrestling with addiction and so forth. And he hadn't had a shower in a couple of weeks. He comes in the foyer and he sits down. This dude smelled so bad that other homeless people cleared the foyer. And you know someone smells really, really bad when homeless people think he smells really, really bad. And so he's sitting in there and I notice he takes his socks off. And I'm on the other side of our glass window and I'm with our receptionist and we're kind of observing this. And she goes, I think you should ask him, you know, what he's doing. And I'm thinking, and I go, why don't you ask him what he's doing? But I realized, okay, you know what? You know, I'm the guy in charge. I really kind of have to step up here. And so I opened the door and I said, hey, what's going on? And he goes, Al, I need you to come in here and help me put my socks back on. And you know what I did? You can imagine, right? Of course I went and did it. No, I shut the door, and I said, you won't believe it, he wants me to go in there. I mean, the smell was unbelievably putrid, and I've smelled a lot of nasty homelessness, but this was the nastiest of the homeless smells that I've ever encountered. And, you know, my receptionist going, well, I'm not going in there. I mean, this is your job. And so, you know what I did is, I mean, his socks, I think I saw one of his socks crawling away on its own power. I mean, this was nasty. And I realized, you know what, I have to do this. So I took a deep breath, and I went in there. And I grabbed his socks, and I put his socks on his dirty, filthy, smelling feet. And I looked up at him, and he just had this unbelievable look of gratitude in his eyes. And, you know, we had a brief conversation, so I really couldn't stay there too long. And he did leave, and I realized what it meant to serve. Serving is just something you take a deep breath and dive into. And we have to understand that we're not going to serve well unless we surrender to it. And we need to understand that service is something that we do have to take a deep breath and surrender into. In the narrative we're looking at this afternoon, then, Jesus is serving, and he's in a situation that is very similar with 12 disciples who don't smell well, and he shows us what it means to serve. He gives us an example to follow, an identity to embrace, and a cleansing to receive. An example to follow, an identity to embrace, and a cleansing to receive. First of all, we know that we find here an example to follow. We're kind of going to go at the end of the text and work back, but Jesus, at the end of this narrative, says, "I have shown you how to love, go and do likewise, and when you do, you will be blessed in what you do." He is, at the very least, giving us an example to follow. He's doing much more here, and we'll get to that momentarily, but Jesus is showing us how to love. And he's showing us that it is very much like taking a deep breath and diving into a situation that you don't want to be in, that you don't perhaps enjoy, that you don't feel like doing. He's showing us that love is something that we engage in spite of the attractiveness of the one who we are loving. And that's difficult for us because we tend to see other people as commodities. We'll love insofar as we get love back, which means that we're not loving that person, we're loving the love we're getting back. And that exposes the selfish way in which we even love. But foot washing or sock putting on is such a great example of love because there's nothing you're getting back but really big whiffs of nasty odor, and you're loving anyway, ergo you're loving in spite of the attractiveness of the one you're loving. Anyone who's married understands how this works. Your wife looked so beautiful on the day of her wedding, but, you know, then in the morning things change, and it's amazing. And how did that happen? And you just, and wives, you know, he smelled so good the night before, and he was wearing this Dolce Gabbana, or was it Guess? And it really smelled good, but it sure wore off by the morning, and he really, really stinks, and he flatulates all night, and it's nasty, and you still love in spite of the fact that your husband stinks in the morning, and in spite of the fact that perhaps your wife doesn't look as awesome as she did the night before the next morning. And those are just sort of the sleeping examples. It gets more difficult as we probe into how difficult marriage can be. Love, by definition, service, by definition, is loving in spite of the attractiveness of the one who you are loving. This is 2,000 years ago. Everyone's walking around in sandals. I'm glad we don't have a scratch and sniff Bible. 12 disciples. It's warm outside. I mean, again, I know I'm picking on teenagers this weekend, and I really enjoy picking on teenagers, but here, all you can imagine now is 12 teenage boys in a room together. I mean, have you been in a cabin with teenage boys, you know, at the end of the weekend? You know, probably haven't showered. I mean, it's not like these dudes were showering regularly. Jesus is washing their feet, and the disciples stink. He's doing it in spite of their attractiveness. I just closed my eyes and said, man, this guy stinks. And I'm going in there and doing what I have to do regardless of whether I feel like it or not. Am I ever tired of hearing this from my children? Dad, I don't feel like it. Well, I didn't ask you if you felt like doing the dishes. I just told you to do the dishes. I quite frankly don't care if you don't feel like doing the dishes. What on earth does feeling like doing dishes have to do with doing dishes? Absolutely nothing. Can I get a witness over here? You know, I was talking about this with my daughter. I just lack motivation, she says to me sometimes. I said, you know, the key to success, you know those people who you look up to and who are so amazing, you know what they've learned to do? They've learned to push forward when they don't feel motivated. You don't sit around and wait for motivation. Don't sit around and waiting for the feelings to come. You know why I'm wearing my Nikes tonight? Right? Just do the thing. Just get at it. C.S. Lewis says, don't waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. This is some of the greatest love advice you'll ever encounter. And I think it's in the program. Don't waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. And as soon as we do this, we discover one of the great secrets. When you're behaving as if you loved someone, you will presently come to love him. If you injure someone you dislike, you ever notice this? If you injure someone you dislike, you'll find yourself disliking him more. If you do him a good turn, you will find yourself disliking him less. Here's an example of how that works. There's a newspaper columnist named George Crane. This is in the UK. This is mid-1900s, I believe. And there was a woman who came to him and shared with him the disdain that she had for her husband. She said, my husband ignores me, he nags at me, he's irritating, I've grown out of love with him, I don't want to be with him anymore. Well, has he had an affair? No, he's just irritating, I don't like him, all he does is sit around and watch TV and drink beer, and I don't need that in my life. And here's what I want, I don't simply want to divorce him, I want to hurt him, as he has hurt me, as he ignores me. And so George Crane has this great idea. He says, well, here's what I want you to do. Don't just go in there and divorce him and try to take him for all he's worth. Here's what I want you to do. Go and be really, really kind to him for about 3 months. You know, when he's acting like a moron, be really, really nice to him. When he's not being kind to you, encourage him and lift him up. When he's sitting around watching TV, you know, ask him if there's anything he needs and be really, really kind to him for 3 months. And then after 3 months, come and see me, because then it's going to be time for you to drop the bomb and tell him you're done with him. So 3 months passes and she comes back to George Crane and he says, well, are you ready? Let's do this. Let's get the divorce. You know, we're going to work through this. How's it been going? And she said, well, I can't believe this happened, but there's an absolute transformation in my husband. He's starting to serve me. He's starting to love me. He's not sitting around watching TV. In fact, we've even gone on this date. Well, are you going to divorce him? No, I don't want to divorce him. I realize that, in fact, I really do love him, and that can be how love works. And by the way, in marriage, that doesn't always work. That could be a bit of a myth, but in that situation, it did. C.S. Lewis is saying, get in there and do the thing. Love the person. If you don't feel like loving the person, well, love isn't a feeling primarily anyway. It's a choice that we make. Love is patient. The Greek word there for patience, there's other Greek words for patience that could be translated patient. The old King James translates that word properly. Love suffers long. And it's amazing to me that when you look at what Paul says about love in that beautiful poem on love in 1 Corinthians 13, the first thing that Paul wants to say about love is that love suffers. And a long time. Love suffers long. And as we saw this morning, suffering is difficult, but it's a choice that we have to make. Here's the first thing that Jesus teaches us when he tells us, where he gives us this example to follow. It is that love is something we do in spite of the attractiveness of the one we are loving. Take a deep breath, get in there, and do the thing. Secondly, there's an identity to embrace here that we need to understand if we're going to be people who love in the way that Jesus is teaching us to love here in John 13. So I started at the end of the narrative, now I'm going to go back into the beginning of the narrative. as Jesus gets up to wash his disciples' feet, John gives us this really important bit of information that is often overlooked. Here's how it's written in the text. It says, Jesus, knowing where he had come from and knowing where he was going, got up from residing on his elbow, and that's kind of would have been the situation. They would have been lying down on their elbow with their heads toward the food, their feet away from the food for obvious reasons. Jesus, knowing where he'd come from, Jesus, knowing where he was going, got up, put an apron around his waist, got a basin of water, and washed the disciples' feet. Here's the point that is being made here. Jesus, understanding his origin, or understanding where he came from, Jesus, of course, has no origin, but understanding that he'd come from the Father, and understanding that he was returning to the Father, had this strength of identity to do this difficult thing that is loving people in spite of their attractiveness. In order for us to serve and surrender to service, we need to have confidence in who we are and in where we are going. That's why Darwin's narrative for life is so dangerous in regard to what it means to be servants. We're not going to be serving people if we think that we come from this primal sludge and we've evolved into animals and finally into people, and when we die we become worm food, we come from nothing, we return to nothing, and life in between these two poles of nothingness really has no meaning. And if that's what we believe, we're not going to be motivated to serve anybody. But Christ knew where he'd come from and knew where he was going. He knew where he was and therefore knew what to do. I don't know if there's dads here who ever go shopping for your daughters. Has that ever happened with anyone here? Maybe at Christmas time. My daughter was saying, hey, Dad, what would you like, honey, for Christmas? And she says, well, I really would like these clothes from this store called Forever 21. And haven't we been over this Forever thing already? Forever's a really long time, and you're only 21 for a year. But that's one thing. So I go, okay, I'm going to go to Forever 21 to buy you some clothes, but I need to know where it is. And of course, she tells me it's across from the garage, right by Aritzia and near Hollister. Have you ever been to Hollister? You need a flashlight to shop at Hollister. You ever notice that? Why is it so dark in there? And I'm going, well, why is there a garage in the mall? I don't even understand. What's that about? And so I'm going, okay, there's a garage in the mall, and I get lost in Hollister. It takes me hours to get out of that place. I got to go to Forever 21. It's by Aritzia, which is very expensive, by the way. So I don't, want to go into Aritzia. So when I get to the mall, Dads, what's the first thing you need to find when you get to the mall? Right? You need to find that big directory. And when you found that directory, you need to find that red dot that says, you are here. Because you're not going to get to go where you need to go in life unless you know where you are. And that's the point that we understand with this origin and destiny stuff. Jesus, knowing where he'd come from, knowing where he's going, was able to do what he was called to do. But this other narrative screams against that in our culture. The other narrative that says we come from apes and when we die we become worm food, I find it very fascinating. I mean, here's a typical, grade 9 science class. This was my grade 9 science class. The public school, of course, you've got the teacher talking about Darwin and natural selection, and nature has this way of selecting the stronger and the weak die out eventually, and that's why species become stronger, and that ultimately is why the human race has become as awesome as it's become. Natural selection and survival of the fittest. The weak are defeated, the weak are killed, the strong remain, and we are that top of the food chain, strong, awesome animal. And then the bell rings and she says, okay kids, you're dismissed, no bullying. And any smart kid in that class is going, what do you mean no bullying? That's why we are where we are. Didn't you just tell us that we are the top of the food change because we bullied everybody else out, and now you're telling me that at recess I'm stronger than those other weak kids, and I can't take out my strength on those weak kids and survive recess because I'm fitter than they are? There's an absolute inconsistency of this particular worldview that Jesus is getting at here. When, as we understand, he knew where he was coming from. He knew where he was going. This is counter to bullying. This is service. There's no service or love in the Darwinian worldview. Rather, it's about surviving and defeating the weak. Darwin said, we must acknowledge, as it seems to me, that man with all his noble qualities still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. So why can't a bully bully? You know, there is this hip-hop misogynistic culture and a lot of that rap music, and it's not so much the stuff on the radio necessarily, but there is this sort of underground stuff, and there's a rape culture among the hip-hop culture, and there's this nasty stuff going on within that particular culture. A lot of misogyny, there's a lot of rape, there's a lot of talk of it, there's a lot of glorifying of it. And when you think about the Darwinian concept of how we got to where we are in regard to our origin, and if our destiny is to be worm food, as Keller says, if the Titanic is sinking, and it's going down in 5 minutes, what difference does it make if we go down hugging or mugging? It doesn't matter. We can live any way we want to. But conversely to all of that, we understand that we come from God. And when we die, we return to God. And that was the motive that Jesus used in regard to the strength of his identity in order to get up from this table, put an apron around his waist, and wash his disciples' feet. And we too need to understand, therefore, our origin and our destiny. How do you understand yourself? That's the question of origin and destiny. When you think of it, says Rabbi Zacharias, really there are only four fundamental questions of life. And you've all asked them. Every thinking person asks them. And they all boil down to this: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. How did I come into being? What brings life meaning? How do I know right from wrong? And where am I headed after I die? These are the questions that we need to ask. And rather than simply thinking we're philosophizing here for a moment, this is the power to be a servant. How do you define yourself? How do you understand yourself? It must be according to your origin and your destiny. We need to understand here that as Jesus got up from the table and washed his disciples' feet, because he understood where he was coming from, because he understood where he was going, this was an expression, a manifestation of his character. This is not Jesus concealing the character of God for a moment that he might wash his disciples' feet. This is the glory of the character of God in God coming to us to serve in this way. And that then takes us to the last point. There is a cleansing to receive. We need to know where we've come from and where we're going, but we need to know more. This is an example of how to love each other, but there is much more. Jesus comes to Peter, and Peter says, Lord, you're not going to wash me. And Jesus then shows us what is really going on here. What's taking place in the spiritual realm in regard to his washing the disciples' feet. Jesus then says to Peter, Peter, unless I wash you, you can have no part in me. Peter, unless I wash your dirty, filthy feet, you will not have a relationship with me. Unless I wash your stinky feet, you can have no part in me. What the feet symbolize, therefore, are our soul and how dirty we are and the need that we have for the cleansing of our sin. Peter, we need to understand, is not being humble when Jesus comes to him. He is being proud. Jesus is showing us that the only way to have a relationship with him is to receive him as he is on his knees serving us. You cannot have Jesus as your Savior until you have him as your servant. Our problem in serving others well is not that we simply don't like to serve other people. Our deeper problem in serving other people is that we have a hard time receiving Jesus Christ as our servant. And unless you receive Christ on his knees before you, you will never get to know him on your knees before him. We understand that one day every knee will bow and every tongue confess, but if you're going to confess Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, you must first receive him as the one who is on his knees washing your dirty feet. If you do not receive Jesus as your servant, you cannot have him as your Savior. And that's what Jesus tells Peter. What I noticed when I was washing, when I was putting the sock on this homeless man, with a soft heart, but with brokenness in his eyes, as I looked up to him, that this was not nearly as humbling for me to put his sock on as it was humbling for him to have to be so helpless and to be so weak and to be in such a pathetic, frail condition that he was unable to put his own sock on. He was the one who was humbled, not me. And as we receive Jesus on his knees before you, we then experience the most humbling moment of our lives. Jesus Christ serving us that we might come and learn to serve others. Andrew Murray has said this: some have thought self-condemnation is the secret of humility, and the Christian life has suffered loss. It has not been made clear that it is not sin that humbles us most, but grace. If we're going to surrender to our need to service, to take a deep breath and get it done, and be involved in justice, not viewing it as charitable work now and again, but as something we must do for the sake of the glory of God in regard to bringing justice to unjust situations, we need to first of all receive Christ as our servant. Let him serve you, that you might be empowered to serve others. Gracious Father, we confess that serving is hard. Loving unlovable people or unlovely people is the hardest thing that you've called us to do. Often those difficult to love people are our spouses, our children, our parents, family members, others in church, certainly this world, as we look at the sinful place that it is. Father, that we would become people willing to surrender to our call to serve and bring justice to this hurting and broken world. And may we see that it begins by receiving Jesus Christ on his knees, washing our dirty feet. In Christ's name we pray.